A little over a century ago, a war was going on in the US state of West Virginia. It was a protracted war, one fought with intense violence, with hand-to-hand fighting, guerrilla warfare, armed insurrection, and even with aircraft. But it was not a conflict with a foreign nation. It was a battle between a multiracial mine workers community on one side, and coal bosses, company thugs, police, and the military on the other. This is Working Class History.
When the Union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the Union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever.
Now, before we get started today, I need to explain something. Long-term listeners may recall hearing an episode about the Mayan Wars before, and they'd be right. Our podcast episode 7 was about the Mayan Wars. However, like all of our earliest episodes, it was basically raw audio from my interview with volunteers at the West Virginia Mayan Wars Museum. So the sound quality wasn't great, and there wasn't narrative to fill in any gaps, explain context, and pull the story together. Now, in addition to working on new episodes, we're also going back over our earliest episodes to re-edit and re-release them in the new narrative format we use for all of our later episodes. This is the first such episode we've reworked and re-released. So the interview audio will have the same quality as before, but there will be added narrative with better quality audio to explain things better and hopefully tell the story in a more cohesive manner. We hope you enjoy it. Before we get on with the main episodes, just a reminder that our podcast is brought to you by our Patreon supporters. Our supporters fund our work and in return get exclusive early access to podcast episodes, bonus episodes, free and discounted merchandise and other content. For example, our Patreon supporters can listen to both parts of this double episode now. Join us or find out more at patreon.com/workingclasshistory. Link in the show notes.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
Over the course of two episodes, we're going to tell the story of the West Virginia Mine Wars, which took place roughly between 1902 and 1922, mostly in the southern portion of the state. We're going to cover incidents including a strike in 1902, a strike in Paint Creek and Cabin Creek in 1912, more strikes in 1920, including the Battle of Matewan and the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921, which was the largest armed confrontation in the US since the Civil War. In 2018, thanks to support from our patrons, we were able to travel to Matewan, a small town in Logan County, West Virginia, which was at the centre of many of these conflicts. Still a coal mining town, every year it holds a reenactment of the Battle of Matewan. There we saw the commemoration, talked to some of the cast, and sat down with members of the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum to find out more about what happened. The first thing they said it's important to understand about working class life back then is how much control mining companies had over their employees, and just what it meant to live in a company town.
So to understand what happened during the West Virginia Mine Wars, you really have to look at what the conditions were like for the mining families who lived in West Virginia on the ground that would lead someone to take up a gun and fight.
This is Catherine Moore, a board member and president of the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum.
So what were those conditions? Those were things like, I mean, first of all, you have to understand that most miners in West Virginia, it was, I think, the highest margin of miners that lived in company towns as opposed to an independent town. And company towns sprung up all over southern West Virginia with the coal rush that we had. And there was really very little, there weren't places for people to live. And so the company had to come and they built the houses, but they also built the churches and they built the schools and the, you know, the stores, and none of this stuff existed. And so what that created was a dynamic where mining families, pretty much all aspects of the society that they were living in was controlled by their bosses, right? The coal companies. And so that left them, you know, vulnerable to the whims of the company. And so you had very sort of logistical stuff, like they controlled the prices at the company store. They hired the preachers. And if a preacher was preaching a union sermon, well, they wouldn't last very long there. They hired the teachers. They, you know, paid the teachers in many cases. They even, since there really wasn't much of a law enforcement in these rural places, they even hired constables to police the towns, right? And so you're looking at an environment where really every aspect of life it wasn't a democracy. It wasn't a very democratic place to live. And the miners had very little access to any kind of democratic power, especially when you take into account that there was, in various places and in various times, you know, quite a lot of corruption. So that was kind of the social control, right? And then there was also a form of economic control that that happened because the companies issued their own, wasn't exactly a, you can think of it kind of like a, their own form of currency, and that was called scrip. And so a miner, you know, he'd have a payday coming to him in 2 weeks, let's say, but he needed food now. And so his wife could go and show up to the company store and say, I'd like to cut $10 worth of scrip off of his future wages. So that then when that payday comes around, well, gosh, he might not even have anything coming to him. I mean, there were times when that happened to families. So you can see how very quickly that could spin into a situation of, you know, almost a debt peonage system, right? And so there was an economic, a sense of, you know, an economic control. And then West Virginia had some of the most dangerous mines in the nation at the time. And so miners were struggling at their workplaces to literally to stay alive.
This is no exaggeration. On the 6th of December 1907, two mines run by the Fairmont Coal County in Monongah exploded, killing at least 361 miners. Between 1910 and 1920 alone, 4,260 miners in West Virginia were killed at work. This is, of course, ignoring the much larger numbers injured and disabled, and those who developed fatal illnesses which would kill them later on. And so, mine workers started to try to gather together to request better conditions from their employers.
When they tried to do that, they ran up against what we call the mine guard system of policing, where they were essentially mercenaries hired by the coal companies to squash any sign of union organizing or talk of union. And so you can see where miners, really their constitutional rights were being trampled on: freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, you know, freedom of movement. You know, the companies even owned the roads, for goodness sake. So you couldn't even necessarily walk up a road without a mine guard if he didn't want you to be there telling you to get lost. And so years of this, right, years of that social control, that economic control, this police state in a sense, you can see how over time that would really wear a person down and make them frustrated to the point where they were willing to fight for those very elemental rights that we have in America.
Contrary to many mainstream portrayals, mine workers were much more ethnically diverse than is often assumed. Many black families had come to West Virginia to work on the railways, which were completed in 1870.
Some of them were from sharecropping backgrounds and coming north to find better opportunity and less discrimination. They could make equal wages as whites in the mines, so that was attractive. There were also immigrants flooding in from overseas, and in fact, the coal companies went out and recruited overseas, and they would send agents out to Hungary, Italy, all these places where there were people starving who needed, you know, needed food and needed to feed their families, brought them over here to the States. They would land in New York. Sometimes there would be an agent right there to pick them up, get them on a train, send them straight down to West Virginia. There's even a town in New River Gorge where I live that's called Brooklyn, West Virginia. And the story goes that some of these potential workers were told, hey, this is a train to Brooklyn. Get on this train to Brooklyn. And they, well, come to find out that it's Brooklyn, West Virginia, and not Brooklyn, New York. So there's a sense that maybe there was a bit of scamming going on. Maybe they didn't quite know what they were getting into, right? So you had this immigrant population of Central and Eastern Europeans. And then you had native-born whites who had been here, you know, migrating westward over many generations.
Lou Martin, another board member of the Mine Wars Museum, explains how coal operators attempted to exploit ethnic differences between workers to keep them divided.
I would say that in southern West Virginia counties, you had a higher percentage of native-born whites and African Americans, but they were still striving for what the coal operator Justice Collins called a judicious mixture, meaning that if they had these different groups and segregated them in the coal camps, they would remain divided and they wouldn't work together to unionize.
In 1902, the United Mine Workers of America, or UMWA, stepped up its activities in West Virginia, sending in famed working class organizer Mother Jones. Born in Ireland, Jones emigrated to America aged 10 as a result of the Great Famine. Although, as with any mention of the famine, it's worth pointing out that, like most famines, the scarcity of food was artificial, as farm bosses and British colonial authorities continued to export food while Irish people starved. Anyway, Jones eventually became active in the labour movement, organising strikes with the Knights of Labour before her work with the United Mine Workers, and was later one of the co-founders of the Revolutionary Industrial Workers of the World Union, which we've released numerous podcast episodes about. In 1902, as a result of her activity in West Virginia, Jones was described by the US Attorney General as, quote, the most dangerous woman in America.
So the United Mine Workers formed in 1890, but they didn't have anything to do with West Virginia barely until 1902. So back in 1902, the UMWA makes its first bid to unionize West Virginia. And that's really where stuff begins. They send in Mother Jones, who is, of course, this legendary labor leader. At that time, she was probably in her 70s or something. But just rained down rhetorical fire on these guys, you know, telling them to wake up. What are they doing? You know, why are they sitting on their laurels? Why aren't they organizing and asking for more out of their lives? So she comes in and she starts in this little pocket along the Kanawha field. There were multiple coal fields that we called them, and the Kanawha field was one that's relatively close to Charleston. So she started there. She started having meetings late at night, in secret, by lantern light often, just spreading the word clandestinely, having these meetings and signing men up to be part of the union. And gradually she starts to get a little more public about it, making public speeches, right? So it's starting to take hold. She's starting to plant some seeds. She winds her way up into the New River field and she starts organizing there, making speeches, signing people up. And 16,000 miners in West Virginia ended up going out on strike with the Pennsylvania miners, demonstrating that West Virginia miners were willing to be a part of this organization. They ended up shutting down 408 coal mines in solidarity, and they had an estimated 180 union men killed on the picket lines during that strike and marches in that 30-month period. It sort of culminates in something that's called the Staniford Massacre, which was a super brutal ambush by a combination of lawmen and armed company guards called mine guards, who surrounded a village where some union miners had been sleeping that night after a union rally, where they were just walking up and down the river, just like with a band, trying to bring people out and sign people up. And so they slept, and when they woke up, these lawmen surrounded the houses where they were staying. These were mostly African-American miners, and ended up shooting them. Six or seven people died in that. So that was really, the 1902 strike is really when you start to get the prototype for like how the rest of these strikes were going to go down. And what that looked like was the miners go on strike, they demand something. The company says, we're not even going to recognize you as having a union. We're not going to deal with that. oh, you're going to go on strike? By the way, we're going to evict you from your homes because we own your homes. So you get evicted. The miners who are evicted, these families set up tent colonies, you know, dozens and dozens fields of tents contributed by the UMW of A. And they live there during the strike. The companies try to break the strike by bringing in what we call scabs, right? Like people who are going to go against the strike and work anyway, and use coercion and violence to break the strike. So a combination of those factors, we see that pattern kind of repeated.
So while the striking coal miners in Pennsylvania ended up winning a 10% pay increase, those in West Virginia didn't. The coal operators' justification for this was that they argued that coal buyers were in the big cities of the Northeast, and Pennsylvania was closer and so had lower transport costs. The operators therefore argued that the only way they could compete with Pennsylvania coal mines was by keeping labor costs low. The UMW did manage to achieve some recognition in the Kanawha New River coalfield, but over the coming years, repression and harassment of union organizers by mine guards eventually largely destroyed the union organization in the area. But in 1912, another major strike took place in Kanawha County, at Cabin Creek and Paint Creek.
That's right, yeah, 1912. So the northern coal operators had all formed an agreement with the union, and coal operators in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Illinois had all formed an agreement to try to standardize their wages because fluctuations in prices and wages were both bedeviling them. And so by joining this agreement, they were hoping to bring some uniformity to their industry. And so the only way for it to work was if they could also unionize Appalachian coal mines as well, because those lower wages were threatening their business in the north. And so the United Mine Workers agreed to make a concerted effort to bring mines in West Virginia into the union. And they went to the place that Mother Jones had spent so much time on, Paint Creek, and she chastised the men for letting their local lapse and urged them to join the union again, which they did. And this was also at a time when the workers were, I would say, at their wits' end. You know, the mounting casualties underground because of dangerous conditions, the low wages, the poor living conditions, and mine guards patrolling their towns, they were ready to join the union.
The workers had numerous demands, including the right to organize, rights to free speech, an end to blacklisting of union activists, for alternatives to company stores, and for the abolition of mine guards. Miners were typically paid based on the weight of coal they extracted, and so this system was also ripe for abuse. So the workers also demanded that scales be installed in all mines, and for the unions to be able to hire workers called checkweighmen, who would literally check the weight of coal to ensure that workers weren't being swindled by the employers.
And so they went out on strike in Paint Creek, and the miners on Cabin Creek soon joined. And that would be a year-long strike, and it would be one of the bloodiest strikes in U.S. history.
So about a year into this strike, by this point, we're talking February, early February 1913. February 7th is the day. By this point, the operators along Paint Creek and Cabin Creek had been bringing in strike breakers for a while now. And one of the means that they did this was they had commissioned a armored train that was known as the Bull Moose Special because of a politician it was affiliated with, who was affiliated with Teddy Roosevelt, who was the president at the time. And
Running for president
at the time. So they commissioned this armored train to bring in not only strike breakers, but weaponry that they needed, they saw as defending their private property from these renegade strikers who were, you know, just anarchists and, you know, blowing things up and all this. It had two machine guns on it, and it had portals for putting the butt of a rifle out and shooting from this train. So there had been guerrilla warfare going on in this area for like the greater part of a year. And not only were miners killed during this warfare, but also company men were killed. So in response to one of the killings of a company man earlier that day or the day before or something like this, the sheriff of Kanawha County rounded up basically a posse. He went out to like pool halls and all over Charleston and rounded up a posse of, you know, former mine guards, current day mine guards, just kind of like a deputy sheriff, just kind of a bunch of lawmen and mine guards. They get on this train and they're going to their clubhouse, which is in a little town called Mucklow, where they have basically their fortress. They've literally built a fortress in this town. And so they're headed there. They have, they pack their guns, they have their guns ready. And as they're passing by the striking miners' tent camp, where not only miners, but women and children and families were living through the winter. As they pass through, the story goes, and nobody, it's like many of these battles, nobody can agree who fired first, okay? So there seems to be agreement that there was a whistle from the train, the lights went out on the train, and then there was firing. We don't know, you know, the guys on the train said they fired first. The guys in tent camp said the train fired first. We don't know. But there was some fire exchanged. And sort of miraculously, only one person was killed as he was fleeing from his house and trying to hide his family in his basement. And he was caught by a bullet and died. A woman who was in her bed had her foot shot. I don't know whether it was like the geometry of how they were shooting or if they were shooting high on purpose, I don't know, but thankfully it wasn't the bloodbath that it could have been. But if you can imagine being stirred from your bed at night by machine gun fire from a train passing through, I mean, that would be enough to really terrify someone. And so it's become a, I don't want to say a legend because it was true, but it's become certainly one of the most repeated and most kind of remembered moments from the Paint Creek Cabin Creek strike because of the sheer drama of it. So the miners and the companies fought for over a year during this strike. And then in the spring of 1913, Governor Henry Hatfield in West Virginia, he tried to dictate a strike settlement between the operators and the UMWA. Hatfield's settlement was reluctantly agreed to by the Coal Operators Association in Kanawha Field and as well as the UMWA officials. It gave the miners a wage increase and a 9-hour workday, but it didn't really address what a lot of the strike was about. So the rank and file, which was led by two men named Frank Keeney and Fred Mooney at this time, who lived on Cabin Creek, they rejected these terms and they led the miners there back out on strike in the summer of 1913. And by the end of that summer, the operators negotiated even new terms with Keeney and Mooney, which expelled the mine guards from Paint Creek and Cabin Creek and allowed for the check weighman, who was the guy who determined how much coal you had mined in a day and then how much you got paid. And there were many accusations that they were being cheated out of their, you know, their wages. And they also agreed to prohibit the blacklisting of union miners. So it was a step, a significant step, towards the recognition of a union by West Virginia operators. So Kanawha, by the end of that strike, really, in the Kanawha field, things were getting pretty unionized. Now, there were more remote regions that we'll get to, talking about Blair Mountain, that still were not unionized and were very much holdouts. So Paint Creek Cabin Creek strike was also the inspiration for the writing of the famous labor anthem, Solidarity Forever.
Solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
There was a socialist poet named Ralph Chaplin who he would go through the strike zone and throw labor newspapers and socialist newspapers out into the strike zone. They were like illegal there. They would cut off that, but he would like go and deliver. And so based on some of the scenes he saw, he wrote that song a little bit later on in collaboration with a West Virginia unionist miner named Rummy. Yeah, named Rummy something.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This miner was called Elmer Rummy Rumbaugh. After the strike, both Rummy and Chaplin joined the Industrial Workers of the World Union. Rummy also wrote a song called Paint Her Red, which is frequently misattributed to Chaplin. During the Cabin Creek strike, some of the mine guards working for the operators worked for an organization called the Baldwin Felts Detective Agency. Like the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, Baldwin Felts played a key role in the often violent repression of union miners.
So the Baldwin Felts hired spies to pose as union miners to inform on the meetings that were taking place and who was signing up to be part of the union, so that you show up for a meeting, the next day, everyone at that meeting gets fired from their jobs because there was a spy there. So that made a pretty, you know, distrustful environment. But the thing I think that's pretty unusual and really kind of chilling to me is the way in which public law enforcement at this time was enmeshed in and sometimes in sort of inseparable from these private mine guards, these mercenaries. In some cases, you know, the mine guards would also be deputy sheriffs, paid not only by through public wages, but paid through private wages through the coal companies and through the Baldwin Felts Agency. And sometimes, you know, when you read through the trials that took place and the Senate hearings and stuff, people will be questioned, well, who are you working for? And sometimes their answers, like, you can tell that they kind of don't know, like, were they part of a public law enforcement at that time? Because, so anyway, so you can see how someone living in a society like that would feel like, well, who's protecting me? You know, if this person that's purportedly, you know, part of public law enforcement is also being paid by the people who are the aggressors in this labor dispute.
Following the dispute at Paint Creek and Cabin Creek, World War I broke out, and, like in many places around the world, the end of the war would see a further outbreak of intense working class struggle in West Virginia.
During World War I, the United Mine Workers made a lot of gains in West Virginia, partly because the federal government was trying to ensure that there would be a steady supply of coal to the steel mills and the railroads to keep the war effort going. And in exchange for not striking, the coal operators had to let the miners organize, essentially. They had to allow union organizers into the coal camps, and they signed up a lot of members, especially around the Kanawha coal field and starting to head to the southernmost part of the state. When the war ended, the coal operators were determined to roll back those gains. And the United Mine Workers were, of course, determined to finally organize those non-union mines so that the northern U.S. co-operators would get off their back and they would finally have a national standardized wage scale. But the operators in southern West Virginia were equally determined to prevent unionization, roll back those wartime gains, and this really set the stage for the very violent conflicts that would follow.
Logan and Mingo counties, two quite remote counties in the southwestern corner of West Virginia, were the largest non-union coal area of the eastern United States and were the top organizing target for the UMWA. The Employers Association in Logan County, the Logan Coal Operators Association, paid the county sheriff to keep out union activists. The sheriff, called Don Chafin, hired an army of deputies paid for by the association who would harass, arrest, and beat anyone suspected of union involvement. In the summer of 1919, rumors spread elsewhere in the state of atrocities being carried out by Chafin's deputies. 1,500 miners across West Virginia armed themselves and marched towards Logan County to find out what was going on. They eventually reached Boone County before turning back, after a commission which had been appointed by the governor to investigate the allegations determined they were largely unfounded. A few months later, coal operators cut wages in southern coal fields, and a wage increase awarded to union miners by the U.S. Coal Commission excluded workers in southwestern West Virginia. This really angered local miners. And in the spring of 1920, non-union miners in Mingo County walked out on strike, and they appealed to District 17 of the United Mine Workers for assistance. District President Frank Keeney responded by calling a general strike of miners in Mingo County. Thousands of miners were on strike, and around 1,500 of them joined the UMWA.
And this was the first real success that they had trying to organize the southernmost part of West Virginia. And what they found was that once again, the company started to evict the miners from their homes because the companies owned the housing. But here in the town of Matewan, it was an independent town. It wasn't owned by the companies. And so the mayor, who had been elected on a reform ticket, along with the chief of police, Sid Hatfield, decided to put a stop to the evictions. And so they went out to confront Albert Feltz of the Baldwin Feltz Detective Agency. And to put a stop to the evictions, there was a tense standoff. Hatfield and the mayor returned to town, and they got a writ for the arrest of the Baldwin Feltz agents. When they confronted the Baldwin Feltz agents later, Albert Feltz claimed that he had a warrant for Sid Hatfield's arrest. A shootout ensued, at the end of which 10 people were dead, including Albert and Lee Feltz and the mayor of Matewan, C.C. Testerman.
This incident and the preceding dispute was made famous by the 1987 film Matewan, directed by John Sayles. We were able to record audio from the reenactment of the Battle of Matewan, which gives an account of the events which took place and some of the people involved, beginning with a description of Sid Hatfield, a key individual in these events, and a fairly unique character in U.S. labor history.
Sid Hatfield was one of the bravest men I ever saw. Crack shot with rifle or a pistol. And he could whip a bigger fellow in the fight. He wasn't but 5'6", couldn't weigh more than 150 pounds. But no one crossed Sid Hatfield, unless they wanted their face in the dirt or worse. That's part of the reason why I made him chief of police. Sid was a mountain boy. He grew up around here and he started in the coal mines over at Blackberry Creek and eventually worked his way up to the mines in Auburn, the Auburn mine. Maybe I better introduce myself. C.C. Testerman's my name, and I was the mayor of Matewan, spring of 1920. Now you might think, that's a fine thing to be, mayor of a small town. And there was a time I thought I had it pretty good. For a young man in those times, I'd done quite well for myself. Owned several prosperous businesses in this town, including Testerman's Jewelry Store. Had me a pretty young wife, Jessie, and we had this little blonde 5-year-old boy we called Jack. But being the mayor of Matewan in the spring of 1920 was no easy job, I'll tell you. Sid, well, he's a typical kind of mountain man. He liked to play pool, he liked the ladies, but he loved a good fight. And truth to tell, that worried me. Even after I made him chief of police, he couldn't stay out of trouble. Why, twice the winter before that fateful spring, I had to bail him out of jail. Once it was for possession of the illegal whiskey. The other time he got hauled in for fighting. That boy just could never stay out of a fight. Some of the businessmen around here criticized me for keeping him on as chief of police after that. Now in the spring of 1920, this area along the Tug River in West Virginia and Kentucky was the front lines in the battle between the coal operators and the United Mine Workers of America. In a place like this, where everybody knows everybody and is related to half of them, there's no use trying to straddle the fence. You're either for the union or against it. And in these parts, Sid Hatfield was the union. And I'll tell you, after I made him chief of police, I pretty much let him run the show around here. And I'll be the first to admit, he enforced the law in the lopsided way. The miners could drink and fight and carry their guns as they pleased. But not many union miners ever spent a night in our jail. If they fought, Sid would separate them. And he had this ability to remind them all that they were all working together for the same cause. And sometimes, if they insisted on fighting, Sid let them go at each other till they wore themselves out. But you let a company sympathizer break one fraction of the law, and Sid have them behind bars in no time. All that spring, the Baldwin Felts detectives had been evicting coal miners up and down the Tug River. So things were getting pretty bad around here. Trouble was a-brewing. And if I would have known how things would have turned out, I believe I would have left my job as mayor and got out of town.
Here, the characters of two Baldwin Felts detectives describe what led to the shootout after Mayor Testament and Sid Hatfield presented warrants for the arrest of the detectives.
Those striking miners, they were out for blood.
He said, well, I'll just return the compliment. He reached into his pocket, pulled out a piece of paper, said, that's a warrant for Hatfield's arrest, and we were taking him back on the train to Bluefield with us.
That's when I noticed the number of guns. Everywhere. There was men watching from the square. They looked on from doors and windows. I even saw a couple of them hanging out of the upper story windows at the hardware store. Everywhere, men with pistols and rifles. We were completely surrounded, and I began to get a very, very sick feeling in my stomach.
Yeah, and then somebody went running out of the square yelling that Sid Hatfield was under arrest.
Then you could feel that tension building.
Then Mayor Testerman come bustling out of his jewelry store. He was a baby-faced man with a big pot belly. He demands to see the warrant.
He takes one look at it. He says, this here's a bogus warrant, not worth the paper it's written on. And that was it. It was like lighting a match to the end of a fuse.
What's going on, Sid?
Claimed I have a warrant for my arrest. He's gone with us.
There ain't no claim.
This warrant's fake. It's not even worth the paper.
That's what I was thinking.
That's lawyer talk. We ain't paying attention to that.
Let me tell you something. Only way any of you boys can take me out of this town is D-E-A-D. Dead.
That's all we've got time for in this episode. In part two, we talk more with Catherine and Lou from the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum about the fallout from the Battle of Matewan, as well as women in the mine wars, and the infamous Battle of Blair Mountain, which was the largest armed uprising in US history since the Civil War. We also talked to some West Virginia teachers who took part in the reenactment about their statewide wildcat strike in 2018, and what the legacy of the mine wars means to them. Our Patreon supporters can listen to that now. For everyone else, it'll be out in the next couple of weeks. It's only support from you, our listeners, which allows us to keep making these podcasts. So if you appreciate our work, please do think about joining us at patreon.com/workingclasshistory, link in the show notes. In return for your support, you can get benefits like early access to content, as well as exclusive bonus episodes, discounted merch, and more. If you can't spare the cash, absolutely no worries. Please just tell your friends about this podcast and give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast app. If you want to learn more about the Mine Wars, we've got a great selection of books in our online store. Just see the link in the show notes. And as a listener to this podcast, you can get 10% off the cost of them or anything else in the store using the discount code WCHPODCAST. As always, we've got sources, links to more info, photos, transcripts, further reading and more on the webpage for this episode. Link in the show notes. Music used in these episodes was Which Side Are You On? By Florence Reese, performed by The Night Watchman, Tom Morello. and Solidarity Forever by Ralph Chaplin, performed by David Robix. Link to buy and stream them in the show notes. Thanks again to our Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. Special thanks to Connor Canazzi, Shay, James, Ariel Joya, and Stone Lawson. This episode was edited by Tyler Hill. Finally, thanks to all of you for listening. Catch you next time.
Poor folks ain't got a chance unless they organize. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys?
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.